Sí, eso que feo.
¿Cómo? Which way? Like this? Like this. Like this.
Oh, shit, you are a real pain, you know. Oh my god. No, 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 that's bad.
Oh my gosh.
Who's it?
Got real resin.
It's really crowded.
You can put the one down if you want.
If you don't want to eat something, it's too short.
Okay, we're going to start today the framework of a unit which we call Hashkacha, Divine Providence. But we're going to directly go to the heart of the matter, which is what's known as in English as the Palm of Evil, and the usual Hebrew title is Tzadik Veralo. Tzadik Veralo often has a continuation. Tzadik Veralo Rasha V'Tovlo. So we also talk about Rasha V'Tovlo, even though Tzadik Veralo is ethically more problematic or more imposing. And we also, at least partially, discuss in the future a problem which very often is not mentioned. That's the problem of Rasha V'Ralo, which most people think is not a problem at all, but as we'll see, some Yishanim thought was a problem. For the sake of this discussion, when we speak about Hashkacha Pratit, we're going to be talking about Hashkacha Pratit as a matter of justice. I pointed out at one of the earlier shiurim that Hashkacha Pratit could be described either from the point of view of justice or from the point of view of beneficence, of good. It doesn't make a difference. Even if Chasda Kreskas, who thinks that Hashkacha Pratit is based on God's goodness, but he agrees that justice is part of it. Justice is something which God is bound to, is committed to. And there is a difference. When we get to Rav Chasdai's answer to the problem of evil, we'll see how it affects his answer. But for the point of view of describing the question, describing the problem, it's not going to make a difference. So the assumption is as follows. Jews or religious people in general, theists, believe in God and believe that God has power and believe that God is good and uses his power. There's Hashkacha Pratit. He's able to use his power and uses his power to do things in the world. And that comes to conflict, or appears to come to conflict, with the fact that evil exists. Now, I'm going to write on the board, in fact, the logical way in which the problem is constructed. Very often you just read about it. So it says, you know, why is there Tzadik Veralo? Yirmiyahu HaNavi said to God, I have a problem. Lama derech rishayim tzaleicha? He in fact asked the opposite question. Why is the Rasha B'Tovlo? He didn't explain logically why that was a problem. He and God both understood why there's a problem. I'm going to describe the exact logical form of the problem, because by doing so, we can understand different possibilities how to answer it. I say possibilities, I mean theoretical possibilities, not all of which will arise in Yiddishkeit for reasons which I think will be clear and I'll make clear. The problem of evil consists of structure is the problem. Consists of a number of assumptions. And one statement of fact, and the combination thereof is understood to be contradictory. And therefore one of the assumptions, or one statement of fact, must be incorrect. You can make more or less by being picky. So I'm going to do the minimal version. But if I want to, I can make it five statements. I think we'll only have three and a half.
I'm not writing as my first statement, God exists. It's included in the first statement. First statement is that God is omnipotent. He has infinite power. The second, because it's an important statement, even though it's not going to really play much of a role with us, is that God is omniscient. He knows what's going on. Very often that's left out, only because there weren't a lot of people who attacked the problem by attacking the second assumption. But theoretically, it should be there, so we'll include it there. Third is that God is good. Okay? Now, let's skip a line. There's a statement of fact that says that evil exists. Okay, over here, very important line, which isn't always explicated. There's a statement of, which is believed to be of logical truth. There's an assumption, there's an ethical assumption, which says that the good, or a good person, how should I put it, endeavors to eliminate evil. Okay, this is a statement which is meant to explain what I mean by the word good in this statement. Okay, the sum of these four statements is contradictory. Because if God has the power, and God is good, and the good, a good person uses his power to eliminate evil, since God is omnipotent, there can't be any evil, but there is evil. And therefore, either God is not good, or God is not omnipotent. The importance of the assumption too is that, technically speaking, if God was omnipotent but not omniscient, then it could be that he doesn't fight evil because he's unaware of the fact that it exists. So, technically speaking, you could solve the problem of evil by saying, of course God is omnipotent, but he's not that smart. There's no particular reason why anybody would say that, and therefore it's not a real possibility. Okay, now, the fourth statement is a statement of fact. Now, if you deny any one of these, you've solved the problem. To deny the fourth, you just have to say that it's not true. In other words, how do you know that the evil exists? You have to bring me examples, and I can argue about them. If we think, for instance, you can claim, what I'm saying now, a claim is that I do not believe that any Jew has ever claimed. Well, any serious Jew has ever claimed. Well, any Jew who I respect his opinion has ever claimed. But it might sound like some have. You can claim that evil doesn't exist. It's an illusion. For instance, you quote a Maimon of Chazal, Kol Mad Ovid Rachmano Letavavid. And then you quote the story of Rabbi Akiva. Or Nacham Ish Gamzu was in the forest and they stole his chamor. That's a bad thing. If he wasn't in, it was a good thing. Etc., etc., etc. So you can click, there's no such thing as evil. There's only, everything is really good. You don't understand it. But if you had the proper understanding, if you could see well, if you could see the truth, you realize everything is good. No Jew holds that. It is a very respectable, it's a very respected philosophical position. It's held by millions and millions of people. Well, it's theoretically held by millions and millions and millions of people, many millions of people in India. Buddhists think that evil doesn't exist. It's just illusion. In fact, not just evil is illusion. The whole world is illusion. Everything is illusion, and it really solves the problem of evil rather neatly. Why do I say that no Jew holds that? Because if you hold that, very, very, very simple reason why the problem of evil is difficult for Jews. If you think that evil doesn't exist, if you think that everything that God does is good, then you are under no obligation. In fact, it's absurd to imagine that you personally should be fighting evil. But obviously, Kol HaTorah Kulo is based on the fact that we personally should fight evil. If you see something bad, you fix it. Ki Tiver Arum Uchesito. If you see somebody hitting another person, you say to him, Rasha Lama Takereyecha. It's very, very, very basic in mitzvahs and in Jewish stories and in the story of Moshe Rabbeinu and the story of Avraham Avinu. There are bad things, we fight against them. If everything is good, then why are you fighting against it? Which in effect is really the same question. If just as we fight against evil, and we expect God to fight against evil as well, and that's where the problem of evil in fact arises. So, it's not an acceptable answer within our framework
to say that the fourth fact is incorrect. It simply isn't true. If there's a little baby suffering, that is bad. That is evil. And based on the first three assumptions, God knows about it, and therefore he's responsible for it. And therefore, something is wrong. Okay? I stress that point because sometimes if people don't think, they just want to get out of it, so sometimes they will say things which sound as though they're denying the fourth. You know, happy-go-lucky kind of people, or tzaddikim, or betzlevers, are really capable sometimes of saying, without thinking it through, I don't think they really believe it. I think they're really capable of saying that, no, everything is good, God knows what he's doing, everything is good, and it's just not true that there's any evil. No one is actually suffering. To say no one is actually suffering, you have to really transcend your own eyes. You have to transcend the world. It's true, there's a pasuk in Tehillim that says, v'loriti tzaddik nezav, zalman v'kesh lachem. David HaMelech had a moment of unbridled optimism. But, okay, it's very nice David HaMelech said that, but I'm younger than David HaMelech, and I have seen Tzadik Nezav Zav Mavakesh Lachem, and frankly, so had David HaMelech. So the pasuk is a question, not the attendant thing. Now, so the real way to answer the problem of evil is to deny one of the first three statements. Basically, either one or three or 3A. I mentioned a solution 2.5 months ago, 3 months ago, when we were talking about the theological proof of the existence of God. So I mentioned how, in order to illustrate how it works, I mentioned John Stuart Mill's conclusion based on theological proof, and that is that God is not omniscient. God is not omnipotent. The theological proofs that somebody exists who is capable of arranging this world, which requires a great deal of knowledge, a great deal of power, and probably a great deal of good, since the world is pretty good. But frankly, when things go wrong, it's because, what do you expect? I mean, he was very, very busy. He made a very, very great world. One or two things go wrong. That's not beyond expectations. That was basically what John Stuart Mill said, was that God is not omnipotent. And if I saw the palm of evil, if most of the world was evil, if the world was a veil of tears, then you would have a question. Then God isn't much. Given the fact that 99% of the world works, and it works pretty well, okay, so you can't do 100%. Nobody can do 100%. Nobody's perfect, as the expression goes, in Mill's case, including God. So that's just an example. How? You can attack the first point, you can say God is not omnipotent. The more interesting answers will play around with the third. Either to say he's not good in the normal sense, or to play around with 3A. Like, is it really true that being good requires you to always eliminate evil? Another possibility, which I think you can't say, even though this I've really heard from serious people, at least in some contexts, the famous Jewish doctrine of Hester Panim does not answer the problem of evil. Why not? Because all Hester Panim does is say, God didn't do the evil. He just looked aside when someone else did the evil. But morally, that's not an answer. Because, as 3A says, the good endeavors to eliminate evil. Or, in B'lashon Hilchatit, lo tamod adam me'echa, is a moral failing. If you stand and watch somebody else drown, it's true, you didn't drown him, the water drowned him, or somebody drowned him, or the hole in his boat drowned him, but you did nothing to save him. That's an aveira. If you had no power, if you couldn't do it, anasuchmana patre. If you had the power to save him and you decide not to jump into the water because it's not my problem, I didn't throw him into the water, you're over on a lav, meaning you're over on a moral dictate, you're not a good person. So Hester Panim does not, even though sometimes you might have heard, you know, like people say, oh, you know, how could this and this take place? Said very often in the context of the Holocaust. It's an interesting Jewish doctrine, it has importance, but not for this problem. It doesn't take God off the hook. Standing aside and allowing A to kill B is morally more or less equivalent. Equivalent is the wrong word. It's not that different from killing him. I say not that different. The difference between Kumbasei and Sheval Taisa. The difference between killing somebody and letting them be killed. I'm saying, but not that great a difference. You're within the context of abetting murder, as opposed to being murdering Kumbasei with your own hands, by yadayim. Morally, it doesn't really solve the problem at all, and therefore Hester Panim is not an answer to the problem of evil. And that's why the first and second statement are so important here. There's a difference for people who are limited human beings. There is a difference between doing something and not preventing it. Because if I do something, obviously I have the power not to do it. But if I just didn't prevent it, maybe there was something which prevented me. I'm not held responsible for not preventing starvation in China. I am held responsible for starving my children. But once you say that God is omnipotent and omniscient, then the difference more or less collapses. I say more or less collapses. There's a difference. You don't get Malkus for Sheva Taisa. But morally, there's not that great a difference, and it's not an important difference for our purposes. What other answers are there which are irrelevant for us? It's true that the Ralbag is famous for saying that God is not omniscient. He also says that God is not omniscient. God means God does not know everything. God only knows universals. He doesn't know particulars. Basically, God does not know that I've just raised my hand now. So God is responsible for the operation of the world and for the klalim in the world, the universals, the laws of nature. If the world was a bad setup, that would be a question. But if you're convinced that the world is a good setup, it rains in the winter and the sun shines in the summer and things grow and there's food and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But sometimes, you know, people make choices and therefore wind up being in the wrong place and things collapse on their heads. According to the Rabbah, God doesn't know about that, and therefore we don't expect him to do anything to solve it. Okay, there is the Ralbag. He's a Jew. He has a title of rabbi. He's a chashuva person. Universally not accepted in the Jewish tradition. It goes against a lot of psukim, among other things. It was a bold attempt to solve not just the problem of evil, but to solve other problems as well. We're not going to discuss it as a live option. So what are the live options? I describe in theory, and then we're going to see them when we have more time. We'll see them more individually because each one is interesting in and of itself. The first option, which occurs to one because one has read psukim, which more or less say it, is to say that there is evil in the world, but the evil is justified. But what justifies evil? So if we take it, this was my introduction. If we're discussing God and Hashgacha as being based on justice, on tzedek, then what we call Rasha V'Ralo doesn't bother us, because it's justified. It doesn't mean that Rasha V'Ralo is good. When someone suffers, that's bad. But when an evil person suffers, even though it's bad, it's justified. You punish evil people, we punish evil people, judges punish evil people, the police punish evil people, the state punishes evil people, not because it's good to inflict pain on people, but it's justified because it's a magile. It's their just rewards for what they've done. So sechar va'onesh is not going to be, at this moment, we'll talk about later on, people thought it was a problem, well, Rabbi thought it was a problem. But sechar va'onesh is not a problem for us. If tzadik v'tovlo v'rasha v'ralo, that we think is okay. So, the most obvious attempt would be, and this, you know, I say it's obvious because that's what the Torah says is true in Parshat Bukhotai. The Torah says it's true in Parshat Re'ei. The Torah says it's true in Parshat Ki Tavo, and in many other places. That everything that takes place, Vayem Shavuot Tishmu Kol Mitzvotai, Ziyakacha, Vim Lo Tishmu Ziyakacha. So if we can explain everything that takes place in the world as being just, meaning that it's connected to Sachar Va'onesh, meaning it's connected to Mitzvot and Averot, then we have a solution. Now again, that's not saying that evil doesn't exist. It's saying is that it's not true that the good will eliminate evil. It's basically playing with 3A. If you had a very, it's a different kind of good. You have a very, very sweet person, you know, like a nice old grandpa. So when he sees people being punished, he'll try to stop them. So we'll say, okay, he's making a mistake. He's being sentimental. But a person who has a true moral attitude will not try to eliminate all evil. He won't eliminate punishments that are taking place for evil people, because as a good person he's in favor of that. It doesn't contradict his proper theory of good. Is that a viable option? It can in fact we explain all the evil in the world as being sachar v'onesh. Not well. Not unless you have too much emuna, too much bitachon. The Rambam, when he discusses the problem of evil, so he divides evil into three categories. Evil that's part of nature. evil that a person does to himself and evil that a person does to others. This is known in the literature as the free will defense. There's a lot of evil in the world, but it all starts from people doing aveiros, from the fact that people have free will. Free will, you have to justify why God made free will. But if free will is not in itself a bad thing, but it leads to bad things, then it's okay that God then responds to it by either allowing the evil to take place and as well as punishing evil people. The problem would be, why is the evil in nature? Why are there tsunamis and earthquakes, etc.? You're going to be forced to say, if this is your kibbutz, that why are there earthquakes, which kill 500,000 people? Each one of those 500,000 people got what he deserved. Something which is rather difficult and illogical to say, especially since there are certain evil things which take place on a mass basis which don't seem to discern who they are applying to. Other famous questions. Children who were born with birth defects. They could not have done anything wrong in the meantime. They haven't gotten old enough. There's evil which takes place, which affects people who could not have been evildoers because they're not old enough to be evildoers. You have to be bar mitzvah or whatever, some age, etc. So it takes a great deal, too much. It takes too much bitachon or fan to say that all the evil in the world is rasha v'ralo. Nonetheless, we will, Bezat Hashem, next week, we will read the Ramban, who says exactly that. And all of us, we know the Ramban, so we can assume the Ramban was not a simplistic kind of pious person. The Ramban is a very sophisticated thinker. Nonetheless, the Ramban, understanding the difficulties, insists that, B'lashon Shal Ramban, Ein Yisurin B'lo Chet, Ein Mita B'lo Avon. Gemara in the end of the first parak of Baba Batra. It's a machloket in the Gemara, and the Ramban paskins that, like the offhand appears to be the more difficult opinion. It would get the Ramban off the hook if he would just say, like the other day in the Gemara, Yesh Mita B'lo Chet. Ramban says, I don't care if there's a day like that in the Gemara, I say, Ein Mita B'lo Chet, Ein Yisurin B'lo Avon, Ein Mita B'lo Avon, Ein Yisurin B'lo Chet. How can you say that with the facts? Oh, the Ramban already has a number of interesting moves to explain how you can explain why there is a sin at the heart of every single bad thing that takes place, even though it doesn't appear to be true. Well, we'll see those ideas, the interesting ideas. I don't believe that the Ramban really works in the end, but nonetheless, Ramban thought it did, which should give anyone pause before he disagrees. We'll come back to this opinion. Right now, I'm assuming, for the purpose of continuing the survey, that's not the way we're going to go. It's just not going to work in a manner which is satisfactory. The Gemara has a concept in that same sugya in Baba Batra called Yisuvin Shel Ava. Gemara does not explain what the expression means. Some people think that means Yesh Yisuvin Below Ava, but the Ramban doesn't think that. But there's a special called Yisurin Shel Ava. God, because He likes you, because He loves you, makes you suffer. Offhand, what would normally be considered to be the... What's the simple shot? When you read those words, Yisurin Shel Ava, what do you think those words mean? Well, we all know, because we've been told this by our parents, basically. Yisurin Shel Ava is the favorite theory of parents. And in order to benefit little children, you have to be mean to them, because they're little children. We wouldn't do this. We normally don't do this to adults, but to children, if you leave them alone, they'll get into all sorts of trouble, and you have to discipline them in order to. Basically, you're hurting them, but it's worth it because a greater good comes out of it. So shalava means you suffer in order to achieve a greater goal. So, for instance, something which is so simple that it wouldn't even be called yisurin shalava. When God made the world, He instilled very, very bad flavors into certain foods which are very, very bad for you. Right? Many poisons have bad flavors. Since we talked about the theological proof in the past, how do evolutionists explain why bad foods have bad flavors?
We adapted.
Of course, bad foods have bad... What's a flavor? A flavor isn't the thing. Bad foods have bad flavors because those people who those taste buds which liked bad foods are all dead because they ate too much arsenic. The people who bimikre mamash as a mutation happen to have a receptor on their tongue
which was very, very unpleasant when they ate arsenic, those are the people who are alive today. They're the same. Okay, but if you're not an evolutionist and you think that God, when he made the world, put bitter flavors into almond pits, which is arsenic, and sweet flavors into things which are healthy, like refined sugar, etc. I'm convinced of that, which is why I still eat refined sugar. It's just inconceivable that it could be bad for you, otherwise it wouldn't taste good. I'm a very big minor when it comes to foods. But nonetheless, now there are certain, that's an evil. The fact is that there are things out there which when you eat them, they taste bad. Or to give the common, the more common example is fire. Why, if I put my finger into fire, does it have to hurt? Why does God make fire hurt people? The answer is because, aside from hurting you, it will also destroy you. And therefore, God made also a thing called pain, and this is basically true, either from an evolutionary point of view or from the divine point of view. Pain is a mechanism by which people avoid things which are bad, not because of the pain, but because of other reasons. Okay, so pain is a bad, is an evil in the world. When God made the world, he created pain. But pain is a good thing because it's, I wouldn't normally call this a sun shalava. It's a very simple, elementary case of sun shalava, meaning that if you've done it once or twice, you learn not to do it again. When I first moved to Alon Shvut, so I moved into a building that the yeshiva didn't own yet, but they were about to own, one of the kollel buildings, and it was still being constructed around me as they did it. It was built by the Sachnut. The Sachnut, 40 years ago, didn't put heat into buildings. The reason is because Israel is a tropical country and it doesn't need heat. It might be true in Be'er Sheva, probably not, but it surely isn't true in Alon Shvut. But there was no heat in the buildings. After the building was finished, the yeshiva came and put in heaters. And they put this huge, in the middle of my kitchen, they put this oil burner made out of cast iron connected to a chimney, and then from there to water pipes, which then heated the whole house. This thing on a given day was approximately 900 degrees Fahrenheit in the middle of my kitchen. So I went to speak to the person who then doesn't work today, and then was in charge of running the physical plant of the yeshiva. And I said, you know, you have to like build something around it so that my little 6-month-old baby doesn't touch it. And he answered me, he was a kibbutznik, he answered me, don't worry, it'll only happen once or twice. Okay, so that's a person with a great philosophic attitude towards the problem of pain. The problem of pain is that pain is a good thing. And why put a god around it, in which case someday there'll be a problem, you know, the god will fall down or the kid will break in. It's much better to not have a god and the kid learns. Okay, so Yisum Shalava is much more complicated than that because you can't find the direct connection. But it works on the basis of Et Asher Yohav Hashem Yochiach, not necessarily because you deserved it. No, you didn't do a chet. But if you did a chet, then of course Yochiach. You haven't done a chet, but it builds character. Right? That's what the teachers in the old disciplinary schools would say. There's another reason why there was no heat in your dorm rooms, because sleeping in the cold builds character. People who are pampered from an early age become modern, soft Northern Europeans. Whereas in the old days, you went to military school, you went to Eton, you were beaten up by your compatriots, you slept in the cold, you had no heat, you had very little to eat, you came out, you wound up being a tough person with character. Of course, obviously it builds character. The question is, which character? But definitely, yeah, it does build. Again, what is that really saying? Again, it's playing with 3A. It's not true that the good endeavors to eliminate all evil. If I see that, I'll give another example. I see that my child is struggling to do something painful, but I won't eliminate it. Why won't I eliminate it? Because it's important that he should solve the problem by himself. I'm giving simple examples. And there's a big difference between simple examples and complicated examples. Simple examples are ones which we all understand. You have to then try to transpose from that to, oh, and now there's an earthquake, and 10,000 people, 50,000 people are in the mud, and drowning, and dying, and God says, builds character. Right? It begins to defy perhaps expectations, but that's the idea. Again, we're taking simple ideas, and you have to then try to see whether you can then explain everything, at least theoretically, on that basis. At this point, I should say something now, which I should have said in the beginning. There's a line in the book by, there's a book on the Palm of Evil called The Palm of Pain by C.S. Lewis. It's the best book ever written on the Palm of Evil. He writes an introduction that he says, I'm writing philosophy. I'm explaining to you how it works. Does that mean that when I confront a given case of evil, my neighbor is suffering, my friend is in the hospital, or whatever, that it's correct for me to say, do I really think that I now have explained it by saying that God is doing it for A, B, or C? No, that's not. There's a huge difference between giving a theoretical framework for this and existentially explaining what's going on. And he says, I'm not that big a minded, I'm not that big a, I'm not that big talking. I'm simply explaining to you how it could be true. Because the problem of evil is a theoretical question that's asked, is it true that God is good? The answer is yes, I have an explanation. Being able to lahatzdik et ma'aseh Hashem, being able to justify God's ways, requires not a brain, but not only a brain, not only a theory, but also a soul and a depth of understanding, which I don't necessarily claim, he says, to have. The same thing is true here. So that's why that allows me to give examples which are really trivial. But you'll say, oh, but you say the same thing if you were standing on a mountain in Indonesia watching the great earthquake of, I forgot what year it was. And I probably wouldn't say it. I don't know if I could say it. I'd be very glib. And that's a very important point. So I'm not now explaining to you how you should justify God's ways. What you should say when somebody dies. I'm explaining what you should say in the Beis Medrash. Someone says, is it possible that God is good and nonetheless evil exists? The answer is, you'll say, perhaps move A, B, or C. Strategy A, B, or C. The same thing is true. I remember one of my earliest experiences with a Lichtenstein. 1965. How long ago was that? Long time.
47 years
ago. So I remember this Chavei very well. And there was a fire in the dormitory of the yeshiva in Baltimore, and three boys were killed. And one woman was the son of a famous yeshiva. It was a big event in American yeshiva's history. And so there was a big levaya. Lichtenstein came back from levaya, and I remember he said he was so shocked. Somebody gave a hesped there. You could say it's a typical religious hesped. Well, anyhow. You know, the Kavaya Kadesh, innocent children, innocent Yeshiva Bach, and they went up in fire. Kiddush Hashem, that Levaya. Lichtenstein thought that it was the most immoral thing he ever heard in his life. I mean, the parents were there, the family was there. He told them, you know, I'm saying, it's a wonderful thing. He said the same thing true. When you go to something, you go to Shiva. People will sit down in Shiva and they will espouse pious things that people, you know. The child's in Gan Eden now, having a good time, everything was wonderful. To say that, so in the circumstances, there's a moment. There's a big difference between giving the theory, not that theoretically is not true, there's a big difference between explaining theoretical principles and applying them by makom mesuyam under given circumstances. So we're doing theory now, we're not doing, it would be extremely glib and probably immoral for me to say, okay, 100,000 people died, how many, 500,000 people died in the tsunami, Yisurim Shalav. God did it so that they should develop character. Some of them didn't develop character, and therefore they died. But the ones who survived have a better character now, which is a good thing. God was being nice to them. Okay? There are other explanations to what Yisurim Shalava mean. I'm giving the easy explanation of Yisurim Shalava. It's Yisurim Shalava or Yisurim, which may be Im Lidei Tov. That's my assumption now. There are more mystical explanations of Yisurim Shalava, which... harder to digest. What other possibilities are there? One can, if one wants, play with God as omnipotent in a sophisticated manner. For instance, the Rambam. As I mentioned, the Rambam divides evil into three categories. Evil in nature, evil that people do to themselves, evil that people do to others. Evil that people do to themselves and they do to others, that's kind of typically rabbi shit. What about evil in nature? The Rambam says the following. God does the best he can. And God is omnipotent. He is omnipotent. Not like John Stuart Mill. God's omnipotent. But it's impossible, logically impossible, to prevent all evil in nature. And as we pointed out in the past, the principle of the Rambam, which is agreed to by all the Jewish philosophers in the Middle Ages, that even God can't do the impossible. Not because he's not good enough to do the impossible, because it's impossible to do the impossible. And therefore it's not a fallacy, it's not a chisoron. Is this a chisoron in English? Quick, help me out.
Lack.
A lack? I need a noun. I could have said lack on my own. It's not a
lack.
No. A noun, the deficiency, thank you. How long have you been here that you can't speak English? I've been stuck here for 40 years. You should be able to speak English. It's not a deficiency in perfect power that you can't do the impossible, right? God cannot make a square triangle. God cannot make a stone so heavy that he cannot pick it up. As we learned in, I went to a very advanced kindergarten. I learned in kindergarten. But we learned in the second grade. Okay? So the Rambam says that God cannot make a physical world which will obey the laws of, the true laws of nature perfectly. Because, says the Rambam, on the basis of Aristotle, since the world is physical, it's material, matter never takes form perfectly. I'm not going to go into this. This is a piece of Aristotelian, I think Moldodash, things consist of matter that a form is imposed on it. And matter, by definition, can never ever get the form perfect. You'll never find a perfectly round ball. Round balls are almost round, by definition. Therefore, God really told the world to be perfect. And therefore, the mountain is, for instance, supposed to stand. And why does the mountain fall down once every 1,000 years? Because it's a material mountain. The theoretical mountain, the ideal mountain, the mountain of Plato, never falls down, never has an earthquake. But the mountain in real life, the mountain that's made out of matter, is going to fall apart. Okay, we're not discussing whether it's a good answer or not. It doesn't appeal to anybody in the room, unless you happen to be Aristotelian, which is a sad thing in and of itself and requires an explanation how such an evil thing could possibly exist. But I'm just giving it as an example. In other words, what the Rambam is saying here about this particular point, he has other answers for other questions. But about to explain earthquakes and etc., or disease, etc., the Rambam is saying is that the perfectly omnipotent God made the world, and therefore it falls down occasionally. Okay, so basically he's not saying that God is not omnipotent, he's saying there's a limit to what omnipotence can do. Omnipotence cannot prevent all evil. There is no way to make a physical universe in which everything will work perfectly. It's theoretically impossible. Obviously you can ask questions, yeah, but he could have done a better job than he did. So I can see, why are there, I want to count how many earthquakes there are a year. Seems to me there are too many, even by this theory. Okay, you can argue with that, yes or no. So I'm just pointing out how the mood works. We're not saying God is not omnipotent, we're limiting God's omnipotence. So this is a very, very important point. So basically, this is the context which Rambam makes a statement that God cannot do the impossible. So this reason he makes a statement, even though it has not finished other things as well. And what other moves could there possibly be? As we raise them, we'll fit them into different categories. It's useful. My claim is the reason why I do this on the board. I think it's useful to see it and to understand and to ask ourselves, if I hear it, even Teretz, we have very, very complicated Teretz, where does it fit in? It helps us to understand what we're playing around with. Okay. Now, the most common and historically the most important answer or discussion of the problem of evil is what's known as the free will defense. In other words, if we do not believe in free will, then the only source of what's taking place in the world is God, and therefore he's directly responsible for everything, and it's going to be difficult to explain how the omniscient, omnipotent, beneficent, good God is accepts responsibility for what's going on. So the way in order to get him not to be responsible for everything is to what's known as the free will defense. In other words, free will exists, and free will be responsible, my free will, your free will be responsible for many things which take place. Now, it has to be very important before we even discuss this to realize that for the free will defense to work, you have to claim that free will itself is a good thing, because God is responsible for the fact that I have free will. He made me with free will. Now, if free will is a bad thing,
words, it leads to bad. It is a bad thing. It leads to bad results. That's my whole point. There's many, many evil things in the world. Why is that true? Because people have free will. Then why doesn't God eliminate free will? So you have to claim this is a complicated idea, that even though free will does as many bad things as it does good things, more or less, it's free, so it's balanced, and it nonetheless is in and of itself an absolutely good thing. It's not, it's, I think that what I just said is true, but it's not that easy to defend it. Mathematically, it's very difficult to defend it to a 5-year-old. Mathematically, it doesn't seem to work. You're saying that there exists something which does bad things, but in itself is a good thing. Because the reason is because free will is not the name of a thing. It's not like God made a tree, and the tree gives good fruit and also gives bad fruit. So he should make a better tree. Right? Free will isn't the name of a thing that does bad things. Free will is free. It's a freedom. You have to say that freedom is in and of itself a good thing. Why is freedom in and of itself a good thing? Because it's the basis for morality, it's the basis for relationship with God. To be created to be created free is better than to be created not free. I'll ask just one question, which I'm going to leave you to think about, because I think it's difficult to answer. B'sofo shel davar, God made a person. This person was free, and this person was an evil person. He was a Russian. Is his creation a better thing? Is his creation more good than the creation of a robot, someone who had no freedom at all? I want to ask the question a little bit more strongly. Is his creation a better thing than not creating him at all? Somebody knows what the Gemara's answer to that question is? Right? Beitila says, Tovlo Adam Shalom Nivra Mishalonivra. So I'm not sure that's Machal Beitila, but it sounds like it. Says, who are they talking about? They're talking about Adam, not about Rashi. But yeah, it does sound like that's the question which Shammai Beitila we're discussing. What we're saying now is that very conceivably, even if when God makes free agents, they all do a lot of evil, it was justified. I feel Iglai Milton Mafeya. It's justified because making free people, making free agents, is a good thing. And what happens later on doesn't detract from the good of it. I think everybody can understand why that's not a simple thing to say. Yes, it requires a great deal of discussion, and in order to justify, you could possibly even disagree with it. If you don't say that, then the free will defense doesn't begin, because to say that God didn't do it, I did it. And again, I've heard this line made very often. People didn't think it out all the way. God didn't kill the Jews in the Holocaust. The Nazis killed the Jews in the Holocaust. That's true. But God made Nazis. Oh, he didn't make Nazis. He made people, and they chose to be Nazis. Okay, he made people who could choose this badly. Maybe it was a bad bargain. If you ask me, was it worth it? Depending on my mood, depending on where I'm standing. Let's say if I was standing in the midst of the carnage, and I was asked, and someone told me, I have a theory. God made free people. That's such a wonderful thing. Sometimes there's a little bit of a bad side effect. Maybe everybody you know has been killed. But look at the beauty of it. They were killed because of the exercise of freedom. So I would probably say, lo mi duvshach v'lo mi yuchzach. It wasn't worth it. In order to use the free will defense, you have to say, b'sofo shel davar, as a gamble, it was worth it. It didn't turn out the way God expected, but nonetheless, it was justified to make freedom is such a good thing that it was worth it. Just a quick sentence. The valuation of freedom as a good thing is a relatively modern thing, and it's not necessarily widely accepted. There are whole segments of society which don't value freedom as much, say, as I do, or perhaps as you do. And therefore, in favor of freedom, if it does good things, if it does bad things, they think it's a bad thing. Halacha l'maaseh, we're all caught up in this. How free are we in favor of freedom of speech? If that produces pornography and incitement and racism, etc., etc., etc. So obviously, it's a big debate here. You know, Americans are famous for being very much in favor of it. Canadians less, English less, and Israel even less. And the answer is because, you know, freedom is a dangerous thing. Bigadol achshav, it's not for what I'm saying now, but bigadol. So the Haredi world values freedom a lot less than what's called the modern Orthodox world. Freedom is a modern concept. It has to do a lot with 17th, 18th, 19th century non-Jewish developments. Not that you can't dig and find Mamari Chazal, which is
discuss why people are very important. But evaluating as being a higher good, greater than its results. Murder is a bad thing. Stuck is a good thing. But if you measure it by freedom, by what it produces, the record will be very, very mixed. In fact, let's really tell the truth. If you have a society that's based on freedom, for instance, America, I'm not sure that the record is mixed. The record might be basically negative. It always goes in only one direction. Things only get worse. If people have freedom, then as the years go by, the level will always go down. That's like a law of it's like a law of thermodynamics. Entropy increases. It's true, and that's why people get very much upset about that. That's why we have backlashes against freedom. That's why we have escaped people who want to deny freedom. So it takes a great deal of really thinking and commitment to say that. I think God created the world knowing. He created the world with freedom involved for these human beings, knowing that it would have bad results, but it's a good thing to do. I think I might have mentioned this in some other context. I don't know if we're here or somebody else, I don't remember, but it's a Maimon that I quote all the time, so probably I did quote it here as well. The Medrash in the beginning of Bereshit says on the second Pasuk, What's the Medrash trying to say? God wasn't surprised when it turned out badly. He created the world knowing that there were two possibilities, and both possibilities, one, two possibilities, there are two realities. They're not just that there might be Rishayim. There will be Rishayim, and there will be Tzadikim. And there will more or less be balanced, more or less. And that's why he created the world. I think what the Medrash is trying to say is that it was a good bargain. God did it al menat. Sheyakein, he knew that what he was doing would have bad results, but it wasn't the bad thing to do. Okay? That's how the free will defense works. God created people with free will because that's a good thing, and what happens later on is not his problem. Because the only way he could undo the actions of free will would be to undo free will itself. I want to explain the last point, and then we'll wait for next week to get onto the Ramban. The last point works as follows in the free will defense. Okay, there's free will. That's a good thing. But when I exercise my free will and I do a bad thing, God should interfere. So I have free will. If I'm able to be nice to you, or I'm capable of pulling out a pistol and shooting you. If you're a tzaddik and I shoot you, God should keep you from dying. This is our instinct. We really believe this. No, I mean, when bad people kill good people, we get upset. Not merely at the bad people, we get a little upset at God as well. We think it's unjust. It is unjust, right? That Rishayim tzaddik. Why doesn't God, in the free will defense, why doesn't God save good people who are being shot by bad people? Because if he did, in very short order, there would be no free will left. So again, I'm pointing out you have to really exaggerate. You have to take free will. It's a tremendous good. Because if every time you shot somebody, if he was bad, he died. And if he was good, he didn't die. In the end, you would very, very quickly realize that it doesn't make a difference what you do. The bad people die anyhow. The good people don't get hurt. And therefore, there's no real free will involved. For free will to work, you have to believe. The person with the free will has to believe that his actions will have results. And he chooses. You don't choose between deciding to do good and deciding to do bad. You choose between the bad and the good result, which I can affect. I choose between causing A or causing B. I have to believe that I have the ability, more or less, I know that I'm not perfect, I have the ability, more or less, to actually cause A and cause B. If God constantly interfered, if in fact justice ruled, sounds like a good thing, if justice ruled, there cannot be any free will. That's more or less the way the Maharal explains what it means, kafale, and how could he get. More or less, I'm saying, same idea. Did God, in fact, force the Jews to accept the Torah? The Maharal says, yeah, but he didn't pick up the mountain. What he did is he came and he gave them the Torah. And at that point, there is no free will involved. When you see the truth, you see that the truth works. They saw God giving the Torah, so of course they accepted it. That's not called free will. Free will means believing that it's possible that crime pays. If we all knew as a fact that crime doesn't pay, there wouldn't be any criminals, which is a good thing. But there wouldn't be any tzaddikim with free will either, because free will is meaningless unless real results can ensue. So therefore, what the free will defense says about God is that God is, he would like to save people. It is evil that good people die, unnecessarily, because there are a lot of Rishayim shooting them. That's an evil. And God restrains himself, doesn't prevent the evil, because you can't have your cake and eat it too. In other words, the fuel of the fence doesn't deny, in this step, this is what I said now, doesn't deny this. It doesn't say that, it agrees that God should eliminate evil. He should save the tzaddik who's being shot. But if he did that, he would lose another good. He would lose free will. And it basically comes down to what? Being omnipotent means you can't, doesn't mean you can do the impossible. It is impossible logically. Okay, we just made it a logical claim. It is impossible logically to also keep all good people alive and save them from bad people, and also to have free will of the good and the bad people. There's a logical, stress the point, a logical contradiction, not a psychological contradiction, because then God can make a psychologically different. There's a logical, it's logically impossible to also have free will and also have no results that are determined by the free will, but only determined by God's justice. Therefore, since it's impossible, the question is, God does the maximum. Now you have to claim, I was pressing beforehand, that it's better to have free will with bad results than to have only good results with no free will. That's a debatable claim. You have to really be convinced that that claim is true in order to make the free will's defense work. God prefers, the good prefers, having free people do bad things to having non-free people only do good things. Which, again, it's first of all debatable, theoretically, and secondly, will sound differently when you say it. In other words, question 84, when do you say theoretical things? To in the middle of the carnage, in the middle of the evil, to say, wow, this is really good, because all these Rishayim are exercising their free will, that's a good thing. It doesn't have the same ring of consistency, the same ring of eloquence, same ring of authenticity as it has by saving Israel. Right? You know? So God maintains a distance. The way to understand my final says that as a method which will accompany us when we discuss the different tables that I know of, is what method of sheep we understand is really do what I did about half an hour ago, is to ask whether a parent would do the same thing for a child. In other words, like the free will defense here says, children don't have that much free will, but they have a little bit of free will and working on it. We try to increase their free will. So there's a theory of education. There is a theory of education, unfortunately too popular in Israel, that says that you let your kids do what they want. And if they burn, they burn. They'll learn from it. But if you tell them what to do, they'll never develop responsibility, never develop a sense of responsibility for themselves, because everything they ever did was determined for them by their parents. This used to be a popular theory in Alonshvut. Teachers in school once attempted to strike to get the parents to stop telling their kids this. There was a whole theory in Alonshvut. It's a whole theory in Israel, but it was very popular in Alonshvut, which says the parents should not discipline their kids, because by disciplining them, they're decreasing their free will. But the kid doesn't want to go to school, so he doesn't go to school. So it's a good way of really saying, I'm going to say theory of how God acts. Would we, as people, do the same thing if we had a similar relationship with the world? God is the big teacher or the big parent in the sky, let's say. Would I think it's possible that I would do the same thing with my children? My perspective is a little bit different than yours, but hopefully, you know, the things I do with my children, which you would probably disagree with, because you're children, but hopefully we'll be able to understand. Okay? Okay, this is the theory. What we're going to do now is starting next week, is we're going to examine one by one certain basic medieval theories of the problem of evil, starting with the Ramban in the Sefer Torat Adam. The Ramban I quoted 4 months ago that said that why do I bother explaining things if in the end you have to have emuna anyhow? And he said it's better to understand what you don't understand than not to understand. Is the final line in the Ramban's long discussion of the problem of evil. And another interesting point, the basic point I already told you. The man says, Ein Yisur Melochem. How he gets to that is interesting, just because it shows his ingenuity, as well as the fact that what he says is true in many, many respects. So that'll be next week, and then we'll go on from one to another till we get to, in about 3 weeks, we get to the truth. What I think is the right answer. But that'll take a while. Okay? So far. Okay.
Which one is it?